or even a West Point military court-martial. The Oregon Supreme Court says we don't care who the underlying fact finder is. We're just going to put the red malpractice jury in the box and let them see if they would have decided it differently. Now, the U.S. Court of Appeals in the Briggs case, that's my best case, the Briggs case, we attached it to our brief. The Fourth Circuit cites Choctaw, and it says, we don't agree with that. We don't agree with that. What you're doing in Choctaw is you're allowing the red malpractice jury to just speculate on causation. The language of the U.S. Fourth Circuit is, that's a cognitive leap over the necessity to have evidence of causation in the malpractice case. So the Fourth Circuit says you've got to have causation evidence. So that's why you have to reject the rule of Choctaw, because Choctaw is saying you don't need causation evidence. We're just going to let the malpractice jury see if they would have decided it differently. And the reason on a public policy basis that the Choctaw rule is a bad rule is that all litigants always think that, you know, they shouldn't have lost. And if all you're going to do is put the second jury in the box, the red jury, and ask them if they would have decided it differently, it's a complete enticement to the client to say, let's just try it again and see if I can win this time. Because I don't have to have evidence of causation. All I have to do is convince that second jury that they should decide differently. And that's why we believe the rule of Choctaw, which is also the rule in the Virginia Supreme Court in Whitman.
If you can prove the jury would have decided it differently, why is that causation?
Okay. See, it's not proof, Your Honor. In other words, it's no requirement of evidence of proof that the underlying fact finder, that's the blue guy, there's no requirement that you put on under Choctaw that you have causation evidence of what a reasonable blue guy, what a reasonable underlining fact finder would have done. Because what you're going to do is just retry the case on a case within a case. You're just going to retry the case, and this time you're going to not have any of those trial errors that are being complained of in the malpractice case, and you're going to let the malpractice jury decide if they would have decided it differently. In effect, you allow the malpractice jury to supply the evidence of causation because they say, well, we would have decided differently. And that's what we're saying is the wrong rule, and that the right rule would require in a legal malpractice case, just like every other case, to put on, here's what happened, here's what should have happened, and here's why it would have made a difference. You see, and what's missing under the Choctaw rule is here's why it would have made a difference.
So, Ms. Yates, is your argument that it doesn't matter what the orange guy or the blue guy or even the red guy would have done with the first trial? So all those colors don't matter. What matters is whether there was causation, expert causation evidence tying any errors of the lawyer into the incorrect result of the first trial.
The second part I agree with, Judge, but actually my colors do make a difference, because what the causation evidence should be is evidence to indicate that a reasonable fact finder, a reasonable decision maker in the underlying trial, whether it be a bankruptcy judge or a jury or whoever it is, would have a reasonable, not the subjective, not whether that particular judge would have, or that particular jury, but a reasonable jury, a reasonable judge, would have decided differently.
What's the expert witness going to look like in this case? Or worse, in a case where we're looking at a reasonable jury? If I'm the trial judge in a gamble hearing, what am I looking for?
You're the trial judge in the malpractice case?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm judging the expert witness.
Because I'm getting ready to argue to Your Honor that the trial judge has a role, because under Robinson, the trial judge is going to be the initial gatekeeper on whether the expert's testimony is reliable.
Yeah, well, that's my question.
That's your question. Okay. Trial judges every day, Your Honor, on motions for new trial for newly discovered evidence, for example, have to decide whether the evidence that didn't get put in was so material that you'd get a different result if you granted a new trial. Okay, and I think that's my best example to show that it is reasonable to expect that a judge, and I would say a judge is an expert, and that you could have an expert lawyer, you could have a former judge, or you could have an expert lawyer as the witness, would be competent to look at the way the case got tried, to look at the way the case should have gotten tried, and I would say a qualified expert under Broders, depending on who your underlying fact finder is, if it was a bankruptcy judge, you probably need an expert that's tried a lot of bankruptcy cases, maybe a former bankruptcy judge. If it's a New York Stock Exchange arbitration.
That you would just march in a whole group of bankruptcy judges and they say, oh no, any bankruptcy judge worth his salt would have decided this way. And then you have another crew of bankruptcy judges come in and say, well, that's crazy. Nobody would ever do that.
Justice Heck, it wouldn't necessarily have to be bankruptcy judges.
But I mean, lawyers are...
Any qualified expert. That's right.
Doesn't that seem a little tacky? Yes.
Well, I'll say this. We would be perfectly happy with the rule that says the malpractice judge decides it as a matter of law. That's our fallback position. Okay? But my concern in making that my first position is I felt like the court would be nervous about taking this away from a jury. But my point is, if you're going to allow the malpractice jury to decide the question, they have to have assistance in doing so. Because otherwise...
Unless it's obvious.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Unless it's obvious.
I'm sorry?
Unless it is obvious.
Well, okay.
In other words, if a client comes up in the malpractice trial, it turns out there was a perfect alibi witness to show I was not anywhere near the scene of the crime, has objective evidence with pictures and videotape showing I was somewhere else. Attorney did not call him. The jury doesn't need an expert to say something that's obvious. We didn't call the person with the ironclad alibi that would have proved you weren't guilty.
Right, of course.
Why do we need an expert?
Well, Your Honor, if you take just that hypothetical, you might be able to get there. But if you added to it other things, like would the bankruptcy judge have let that evidence in?
Would it have been admissible?
Right. Those kind of questions, you might need an expert. But certainly in my case, for a complex trial where the argument is you should have put this witness on when my guy was saying, well, but that witness would have hurt my case. Those kind of questions are not obvious scenarios that you would not need some help on the causation front on that. Now, what I was getting at with this last point on causation is just that the judge does have a role. And the reason I think this would be a reasonable way for the court to go at this is that you have the expert proffer, and then there's a Robinson determination on whether the expert's opinion is reliable. And so there the judge is really doing what Judge Wittig did at the end of the trial in the malpractice case in this one. You know, Judge Wittig J&OB'd it and said, we think there's just not evidence of causation here. But a judge would be permitted to, of course, would have to, on a Robinson challenge, look at the testimony. And, Your Honor, it could be...
What are the factors?
The factors for?
Evaluating reliability. If it's a car crash, you're talking about science, rules,
right.
Siphoning, like the last
right.
case. If it's this...
Right. Your Honor, I would say...
peer review.
Okay, I would go look at your opinion in R.C. versus Burroughs, where you talked about the adequacy of the affidavit that was given on whether the lawyer had handled the settlement right, and you were unhappy with the language in the affidavit, and you said, now look, this is how you should have done it. The lawyer should have looked at this, and should have talked about how you would have structured settlements. To me, it's the same thing. The expert looks at the way the case got tried. He looks at whether there was a missing alibi witness. And he says, look, in my experience, this would have made a difference. And, Your Honor, what's the difference between that and a district judge deciding on motion for new trial on newly discovered evidence? This evidence is so material that it would result in a difference if I grant a new trial.
Because he was there, because he saw the trial.
Well, the bankruptcy, okay. In the malpractice case, the expert has got to be knowledgeable about the underlying trial. He's also got to be knowledgeable about what should have been put on. So he's probably going to be there. He's probably going to hear all the evidence in the malpractice case. Or at least he's got to be familiar with it. And see, that's what's wrong with the expert testimony in this case, and that's at tab 5 of our poster book, maybe tab 4, where Steve Peterson from the State Bar testified, and he said, well, I don't know what the available evidence was that could or should have been put on, and I can't tell you what other evidence might have been out there. And this is the evidence that the testimony that our opponents say is evidence of causation. See, this expert didn't do what we're saying an expert should do and can do to help the jury establish causation, or alternatively, Chief Justice Phillips, if you're not comfortable with that, let the malpractice judge decide. In effect, that's what happened here. When Judge Wittig said, I heard all the evidence and you don't have any evidence of causation, Judge Wittig was saying, I, Judge Wittig, malpractice judge, sitting here on this trial, say there's no evidence of causation. So, you see, that's the check that you would have if an expert had testified. He could have still made that determination if he thought the expert's testimony was unreliable. But the point is, you can't do it without any evidence of causation. You can't do it without any evidence, because then you're just letting the red malpractice jury decide how it would have decided the case. And that, we think, is terrible public policy, among other things.
As a trial judge, I never had a lawyer expert witness. So I'm having a hard time getting my mind around this, but getting my mind around a jury saying what a reasonable bankruptcy judge sitting as a finder of the fact would have done.
It's tough, isn't it? It is. It's hard. And you can see it more easily if the underlying fact finder were a jury. And see, that's what the court had in Choctaw. In Choctaw, the underlying fact finder... It was a jury, I think. And so if you put jury against jury, blue jury to red jury, that's when I think it looks deceptively simple to say, well, just let the red jury decide what the blue jury would have done if they'd heard the evidence. But when you start thinking about, no, you're deciding a rule of law that's going to apply whether the underlying fact finder is a judge, a jury, an arbitration panel, then you have to really stop and think about whether the Choctaw rule really makes any sense. So this is an area of the law that needs some clarification. And really, the point I want to make is we're not asking for a special rule for legal malpractice. We're not asking for a special rule for lawyers. What we're asking for is that the same rule that applies to everybody else, just like the GM case you just heard where you're saying, is there really evidence of causation? The same rule that applies to all other cases has to apply to legal malpractice. You have to have evidence of causation in the malpractice case, and if causation is not within the layperson's knowledge and expertise, you've got to put on an expert. And the expert ought to be subject to the rules of Robinson and Hafner and everything else that we do in other cases. Now, I'm
probably wasting your time, but just to think this out to logical extension,
please.
U.S. Supreme Court argument, make a poor argument.
Right.
Unprepared. Send in another lawyer at the last minute who hadn't studied. Then a jury in Harris County, Texas, or Loving County, Texas, is going to decide what five reasonable U.S. Supreme Court justices
Your Honor, isn't that appellate malpractice, and won't that come under your rule?
Well,
that's a judge case.
Okay.
But I see your dilemma. I mean, it's not an easy thing to deal with. If I'm wrong on causation, and I'm not, my time's up. If I'm wrong on causation, I would still get a new trial under the Formosa case, because Judge Wittig is right that there's not legally sufficient evidence of $3 million in actual damages. And under Formosa, that would mean a new trial, not a rendition for some smaller amount of dollars. That's my time.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May
it
please the court,
Mr.
Levon, both Natanian and Mr. Valerie Davenport, is an argument for the respondent. Mr. Hovnatanian will open with the first 10 minutes.
May it please the court. My name is LaVon Hovnatanian, and I represent the respondents' cross petitioners in this case. In my time before the court, I will respond to the other side's arguments, in other words, their petition or their petitioner's brief on the merits. And in her time, Ms. Davenport will advance our own petition. I want to start a good place to start is with this court's own jurisprudence from 1989 in the Millhouse case, where this court said causation in malpractice cases, in legal malpractice cases, is a question of fact with one exception. And that exception, as Chief Justice Phillips noted, is appellate malpractice, which of course we don't have here. So we start with the understanding that comes from this court's own case that causation in trial malpractice or any other kind of malpractice except appellate malpractice is a question of fact. Now, courts across the country have held that causation in trial malpractice cases still is a question of fact, no matter who the fact finder is, whether it's a judge, whether it's a jury sitting as the trier of fact. The Supreme Court of Washington said so.
I mean, causation in a medical malpractice case is a matter of fact, but it's not information that's within the knowledge of the average layperson, so you have to be guided by medical testimony.
Respectfully, Your Honor, not always. Because,
I was going to say, why don't we carve out a legal exception only if it's something like res ipsa loquitur, which is very difficult to show? Why wouldn't we use that same construct here?
Well, we think you should, and it already exists in Texas law. In the Delk versus Douglas case, in the Fifth Circuit's case of Strieber.
Well, but it sounds to me like you're applying it on the liability piece, but not the causation piece. In other words, you're standing up and saying they didn't do this, they didn't do that, and therefore malpractice, therefore damages. But you haven't, it appears to me that there's nothing in the transcript here that shows if you had put on a case, you would have won.
Your Honor, let me start back at the beginning of your question. I think the construct that we suggest is the one that comes from those Texas cases, like the Court of Appeals version of R.C. versus Burrow before the case got to this court, and Delp and Strieber, where the court said, and none of those courts said res ipsa, but it is obviously close to res ipsa, that if the causation is obvious, if the causal link is obvious to a layman, then as Justice Brister pointed out, you know, in a case like that, you don't require expert testimony. Now, to the second part of your question, we think that exception applies in this case because, respectfully, there is evidence in the record that the Turter and Associates would have prevailed in the underlying adversary proceeding if
specifically?
Your Honor, there's actually three strata of evidence categorized in our brief, and I'll get to the most direct is perhaps the lay evidence from Mario Turter. For instance, Mr. Turter testified that he was forced to settle claims because of the loss that they took in the adversary proceeding, that he was forced to surrender other claims, that he was forced to pay money, that he got sued again.
Wait, the question is evidence that he would have won if
yes.
he had tried properly.
Oh, okay, Your Honor. I'm with you. I go back to Mr. Turter's testimony. He testified that the evidence was there. In fact, that's almost a direct quote, although he goes into much greater specifics than that. I'm paraphrasing. That the evidence was there. Had it been put in front of Judge Abel, the bankruptcy judge, we would have prevailed.
How can he know that? I mean, how can he, if he's not a lawyer or a judge, how can he begin to say that?
Well, Your Honor, and that goes back to the application of the exception. Every court to rule on the exception, including the Texas courts that I mentioned, have said that when that causal link is obvious, then lay testimony from the client will be sufficient to show causation.
But these cases like Delp are cases where they don't have the intervention of a judge or jury. It's where the client is taking advice and shows what happened as a result of that advice.
That's absolutely
and
true.
And this is very different when you're going through the court proceeding. And what in this, same question everybody else, what in this record shows that the judge would have ruled a different way had this other evidence come in on in a two-day limitation?
Well,
this wasn't like you have all the time in the world.
Very, very true. Let me back up. There are three key points to make here. First of all, this is not just a trial malpractice case. If you look at the three liability questions submitted to the jury, numbers 1, 4, and 5, they cover not only the malpractice at the trial, but also the pretrial malpractice. For instance, question 1 says the preparation or trial of the adversary proceeding. So it's not quite accurate for the other side to say this is a case about trial malpractice.
And the jury can decide what's adequate pretrial work without expert testimony.
In an obvious case, yes, Your Honor, they can. And that's exactly what they did.
What was obvious about this? I mean, the underlying case, to the extent I could gather it from the briefs, was something about we would have kept doing these programs after 83, 84, and we would have entered a contract. What evidence would have conclusively, obviously proved we would have entered a contract when one party of the contract can just say no?
Well, Your Honor, there was a lot more to it than that.
Well,
that certainly.
But I mean, that was the most of it, wasn't it? Most of your damages was we would have kept getting these things for later years.
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, I don't know that I would go that far. A huge portion of the damages in the adversary proceeding were for commissions on sales that had already been made and that money was already owed. Not just commissions, but the bonding premium that was advanced by the Turters. There's several categories.
But it wasn't a brief, that we would have had those if you had contracted with us instead of not getting the bonding and therefore it fell through and you did it on your own.
Correct.
But I mean, what obvious proof is there that you would have had to have entered a contract with us?
Well, but Your Honor, I guess the best answer to that question is there already were two contracts in existence, and the question was not so much future contracts.
But there was nothing in them that required the ranch to keep contracting with you and only you forever.
There was. Well, not forever. No, there was. There was not forever. But there was an exclusivity provision that said you are my agents for these sales and nobody else will be. And that was part of the Turter's breach of contract.
But that ended in 83, right? End of 83.
I want to say, Your Honor, it did end in 83 or 84. It may have gone on into 84. But certainly I wouldn't quibble with 83.
Part of what bothers me about your case is that we got along in the Anglo-American legal system for several hundred years without the concept of pretrial. You just came down and told your story, and the fact finder resolved it. And it seems to be an underlying presumption of your position that a lack of exhaustive pretrial is per se negligence that causes damages.
No, Your Honor. No. Respectfully, that's not our position. And that gives me a chance to respond to a previous question about what was obvious. We're not saying pretrial has to be exhausted. We're not saying at trial the lawyer better perform like Clarence Darrow. What we are saying and what makes this case what we think and what the jury thought an obvious case and the Court of Appeals thought an obvious case is essentially six things that were lacking in this case. First of all, the fact that the trial lawyer had no experience in adversary proceedings.
Let's stop right there. If the case, it's a malpractice case, the doctor was drunk and cut off the wrong leg, okay? Now, the doctor's attorney also is drunk at trial, calls no witnesses, objects to, and sleeps through the trial. We all agree that trial attorney's negligence. But the problem is he couldn't have won that case. So it doesn't matter how bad he was, if he was drunk and cut off his own leg at trial. The question is, what would he have done to win the malpractice case with a drunk doctor that cut off the wrong leg? And the answer is nothing.
Well, Your Honor, there is an answer in this case. And the answer is do some discovery. Send out interrogatories.
All could have been complained about my drunk lawyer. But what would they have found that would have shown, unless there's some evidence the doctor wasn't drunk, or didn't cut off the wrong leg, it's not going to get any better,
true,
whatever the lawyer does. So what would have gotten better if Ms. Mingledorf had done all these things?
The evidence that was admitted into the malpractice trial of all of the evidence that should have been admitted into the underlying adversary proceeding.
Again, that was mostly stuff she didn't do.
Correct.
But I need the substance. I would have called three more witnesses. I mean, every guy that gets convicted said I would have called five more witnesses and they would have said I didn't do it.
Very true.
But who got on this? What was presented at the malpractice trial where somebody said specifically this is why the ranch breached the contract?
Your Honor, I'm out of time. May I briefly? Thank you. It's summarized in our brief, and I'll give you the best possible example. The best possible example is the evidence from the witnesses, third-party witnesses, not affiliated with either side, who could have come in and said, this is what Mr. McKellar did that was wrong that cost the Turters this money. For instance, the investors with whom Mr. McKellar closed the deal, unbeknownst to Mr. Turter and his family, when there was an exclusivity provision in the contract that said only Mr. Turter and his associates get to close those deals and get paid on those commissions. That's just one example. There's a host of others.
The expert, Mr. Peterson?
Yes, sir.
He never was asked about this subject at all.
Your Honor, about, I beg your
causation, pardon. About the causations.
That's actually not that easy of a question to answer. He was asked about it by Ms. Davenport. He was.
And he said?
Well, he said, without getting into the extent of it, the key phrase that the parties are arguing about in this case was the evidence that was offered and admitted at trial caused Judge Abel to make the decision that he made. And, of course the parties are...
cited in court of appeals, but anything else besides, I mean, was he just asked point blank, would this have come out differently?
Were those exact terms used? No, Your Honor. Did he give testimony in and around the excerpt that I just read to the court from which that conclusion can reasonably reach? Yes, absolutely.
Thank you. You mentioned,
you mentioned
6 points that you believe were lacking, and I think you got to two of them.
Your Honor, I'll summarize those. I got to two. The lack of experience, the fact that virtually no discovery was done, including no written discovery. The third one was that there was no preparation for trial. The fourth one was that at trial, a case for the Turters was barely put on. The fifth one was that, correspondingly, the case that the McKellars put on was barely defended against. And the sixth one, of course, which is all throughout the record, is that all of this happened with no supervision whatsoever.
Which gets you to negligence. But you're saying you don't need evidence that they would have won the case if it had been done right.
Oh, no, Your Honor. I'm not saying that. Respectfully,
so
no.
You agree you do need evidence
of causation.
Would have been
won. Oh, absolutely. We have never taken the position we don't need evidence.
But that's
of causation.
Where I'm having trouble. I don't see where that evidence is.
Well, aside from...
regardless of who it came from.
Sure. The other area I can point the court to is just the facts that we argue in our brief regarding obviousness. And that is that the six facts that I just mentioned to Justice Wainwright could have led a jury to conclude, well, of course they lost. Look what happened and look what didn't happen. Of course there's a causal relationship between no discovery, not preparing for trial, not putting on
again,
a case.
That's negligence.
And losing, correct.
Okay. I still haven't heard anything that tells me they would have won, and I think what you're telling me is we can glean that from this record.
That's correct. That's correct, Your Honor. Maybe I should have said that to begin with to answer your question. That's correct. That's where the exception comes into play if the causal link is obvious between the negligence and the damages. If you can glean from the record, as the jury did.
As a matter of law, they would have won.
I wouldn't say as a matter of law. I would say as a matter of fact.
We can't do that, can we?
Your Honor,
can we determine that as a matter of fact?
Can
they would have won?
I'm sorry. A jury can. Are you asking me that, or whether this court can?
Well,
I'm sorry. I didn't understand.
It's just hard for me to see without that the lay person could determine, based on what might have come in, the underlying case was winnable. And you're saying it's so obvious from this record.
Correct. Correct. And that's why, if you look at the cases that apply the exception, unanimously, those cases will say lay testimony from the client in an obvious case is enough to get the job done. That's because you've got the negligence and you've got the damages. The causal link is obvious, and all the client does is validate it. All the client does is come in and say, I was there. I know what happened, and here's what happened. In an obvious case, which we contend this case is, then as a matter of fact, the causation element is met.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. I'd like to take a step back, and before I get into our cross points, talk to the court for just a minute. First of all, as if you were finders of fact, I know this court does not have fact-finding jurisdiction, but a bankruptcy court can wear two hats. It is not just a court of law. It can take off its robe and sit as a finder of fact, like a person in a jury box. It is not a bankruptcy judge, Your Honor, Judge Phillips, Justice Phillips. As it does that, it is like a one-man jury. Judge Abel was like a one-person jury sitting there with no greater expertise. He was supposed to sit there and disregard his greater expertise as a fact finder and be a finder of fact. Listen to those facts, disregard, not bring in outside expertise about what he knew about cattle. He was supposed to still obey all of those rules about fact finders and listen to those that evidence and make findings of fact based on the evidence he heard. And he heard certain evidence that was introduced in the trial in Judge Whittick's court. And all of that evidence bound was admitted at that trial for that jury to look at. That fact finder, another fact finder made up of 12 people, this time, who did not also have another job as a person trained in the law to make conclusions of law, but another group now of 12 who were supposed to make findings of fact. And what they said is, okay, we're sitting here as finders of fact, and yes, with these volumes of evidence that have now been introduced, we would have made the same decisions of this fact finder had we seen these volumes. But now, and Judge Brister, you asked, what else did they see? Well, there was a thing called Green Creek, or I can't even remember. It's been so long since I tried this case. But they saw that the Turter prospectus was being used. And if you don't mind, I think I have water. That it was being used to sell cattle. The exact Turter prospectus was being used by McKellar to market cattle for the, what is it, Green Creek or something, cattle company? Okay. Using their prospectus.
Is that a copyright claim? Or?
Well, no, they had drafted it, and they had $50,000 that was a to be charged for each unauthorized use of the Turner prospectus. And also, the Turners had told Mr. McKellar that to dilute the market using, you know, that that's why they had an exclusivity provision. They said, look, we can't sell too many of these. What makes them able to be sold is to keep the number down. That holds their value. Okay? And that's why when Mark Sorrell was selling these, that he said, they wrote him and said, you can't be doing this because it's hurting the value of these offerings.
But surely it can't be malpractice that if you retry this case a second time, a jury goes favorable to you when you lost it as the lawyer the first time.
Wait a minute. It can't be malpractice.
It cannot be malpractice that I go try a case and lose it. And when we retry it, in the malpractice case against me, it gets won because of another strategy. There's got to be something more, doesn't there?
Well,
lawyer malpractice premiums are going to go pretty high.
No, but don't you think it's malpractice if I buy Clarence Darrow and I send in, you know, Snedley Snodgrass, a first-year law student, or even somebody else who's never tried a civil case and never seen a bankruptcy court and knows nothing about cattle embryos, because that's what happened here.
So your argument is it's okay if it's really bad malpractice. If it's just regular malpractice that the second lawyer says, well, I wouldn't have called that witness or I would have called another one, that's a different case.
Now, what we had here, we had an expert testify about all of this was negligence.
Right.
Liability.
But the question is
causation.
But the chief's question is, another lawyer can always second-guess the way you try a case. Another lawyer can always come in and say, I would have tried it differently. That's supposedly why you hire lawyers, right?
That is true. But when you're talking malpractice, you won't always have a lawyer say, this is negligence. You know, we do have, it's almost like in medical negligence cases. We a lot of times have issues of, you know, and it rings in my head all the time. Medicine's not an exact science. You know, there's a judgment call involved, okay? But this wasn't a judgment call. Tom Alexander knew he was supposed to be there, and he didn't show up. He promised the Turners that he would represent them personally. You know, that's what was found, even by the Court of Appeals.
It seems like, though, all of our argument is about liability. And,
well,
I mean,
no.
Let's just presume the liability is stipulated.
Okay, and then what we have is a man who said, I will supervise the operation of this case and spent 2 hours. And as a result...
liability.
No, but in development of the case. Okay? Now, the question is, did that cause it that somebody who had boxes of evidence produced never looked them over prior to trial, and none of that evidence made the exhibit list? But in the case when it was tried later,
that those exhibits would have gotten you...
Right, and that's what I did. Because what happened was we introduced the scarcity of evidence in the first trial. We introduced the entire record. Said, this is what they got. And then we said, this is what's available. Look at the Spring Creek Cattle Company. Look at the fact that there were these prospectuses being used and sales were being used to dilute the market. Look at the fact that the Turters got loan money to finance their sales that McKellar used for his other debt, rather than funding the buyers that the Turters were sending to finance their sales. McKellar used that money to buy or pay off his own other debt. When they set up the bonding thing, he wouldn't even pay the bond premiums. This was an exclusive deal. If they did sell out, they sold out quickly in 82 for the last quarter of the year. They sold out totally in 83. And they had the 84 deal, but he cut it to December 1st so they couldn't get the end of the year market. And then he didn't put the funding in place and use the funding they got for his own deals. Okay, none of that came in. So the question is...
Was the second trial, the malpractice trial, concluded in 2 days?
But it wasn't limited to 2 days. She didn't have any witnesses there, Your Honor. That was the problem. You know, when the court...
How long? I understand.
We did have 30 hours aside for the malpractice trial.
How much? 30
hours aside.
Any other questions?
But we had to do, but if you look at that, that's two trials. We did a trial within a trial.
Any other questions? Thank
you, Your Honor. Okay, and we did have the questions on the trial amendment and the...
Well,
I know by
your time's up, and you chose to argue
for
main liability. If anybody has any questions, it doesn't appear they do.
All right. I just didn't want the card to go off on. Your Honor, it was a question of judgment as to what got put on at the bankruptcy trial, because Judge Abel, despite the fact that he had been asked to give 3 or 4 days by the bankruptcy lawyer that was co-counsel, said, no, you're only getting 2 days. And it was a question of judgment for Ms. Mingledorf, who I think has been maligned in this case. She's a very fine trial lawyer in white-collar criminal cases, and she testified in the malpractice case that she made judgment calls about whether to put on the three witnesses, the only three witnesses that they called in the malpractice case that were not called in the bankruptcy case, only three. Two of them were the bankers, and Ms. Mingledorf explained they gave testimony that hurt our side. That's why I didn't put them on. And the third one was Chris Turter, and remember there were three Turters, Mario, Chris, and Stephen, and she didn't put Chris Turter on, but she put the other two Mr. Turters on, and Chris's testimony would have been cumulative. And here's why it's not obvious. The big thing they're complaining about is the bankruptcy judge's fraud finding, and he says on the record in the bankruptcy hearing at the end of the trial, he compliments both sides, and he says, you know, this is just a swearing match. I just have to decide whether I believe Mario and Steve Turter about what happened in the meeting when the fraud allegedly occurred, or do I believe Dr. McKellar and his accountant, because they were all four at the meeting and they all four testified, and this is a swearing match, and I just got to decide who I believe.
What specifically did the Turters, what fraud did they commit, what did they say? What,
to get Dr. McKellar not to cancel the contract for 84, they had a meeting in September, and at that point, the bankruptcy judge found that misrepresentations were made by the Turters to Dr. McKellar and his accountant. And that was the fraud. And that's the fraud that they complain about in the malpractice case. But the point I'm trying to make is that was the bankruptcy judge's call on the credibility of the witnesses.
And when that's the issue, what the fact finder would have done, and it clearly turns on credibility of witnesses,
that part
demeanor, how can that be second-guessed in a second trial by anybody who wasn't there the first time? Because who will say, well, their eyes shifted around, or they squirmed in their seat, or they kept looking at the ceiling?
I think the argument that the other side would make, if they were here, would say, if you'd also put on Chris Turner, that might have made a difference. Now, an expert, my expert in the malpractice case, would say, you know, Chris's testimony would have been cumulative. Wouldn't have made any difference to that bankruptcy judge. But a lay jury in the malpractice case may not realize the effect and the importance of cumulative evidence. That makes my point on why expert testimony.
This question is much more generic. Yeah, I'm just saying, in the malpractice trial, when we're trying to decide causation,
right?
What kind of evidence can you put on that the decision in the underlying case would have been different when it turns on credibility issues and nobody was there?
Right. Well, now that, unless there's somebody else to put on who was there, that aspect of this case, and the fraud was only one aspect, there were other claims too, that aspect of the case may be something where the malpractice plaintiff can't make a case. Maybe he can't prove that it would have made any difference, that there was any causation.
But certainly if you called some sort of expert, like a bankruptcy judge, I mean, assuming this can be done, which I'm not sure how it can be done, but assuming that it can be done, and he comes in and says, well, yes, I think this would have come out the other way.
Right.
And you say, well, wouldn't it depend on credibility and on cross-examination? He says, well, probably it would have, but I can tell from this record it would have come out the other way.
Right.
Is that reliable testimony?
See, under my scenario, the malpractice judge would probably say that's not a reliable opinion. You can't testify to that. But you've got to keep in mind, in this case, the fraud finding is only one aspect. Ms. Davenport would tell you, well, that you may be right, Judge Heck, with respect to the fraud, but I have other complaints about the way Mr. Alexander or Ms. Mingledorf handled the bankruptcy proceeding besides just the testimony on fraud. But I'm with you on the fraud, Judge Heck. I bet you couldn't reliably put anybody up there that would say that it would have made a difference.
And I suppose if you contracted for someone in particular to be there, and that was very important to you,
yes, sir,
irrespective of whether you were going to win or lose,
right,
and that didn't happen, there would be a breach and maybe some other problems, but you'd still have causation problems, I suppose.
You sure do, particularly when you predicate your damages in the malpractice case on determination that the adversary proceeding would have come out better or more favorably.
And that's what all the damages and all the fact findings went to in this case.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. And that concludes the argument in the second case, and the court will now take another brief recess.
All rise.